Hey, I'm Dan Runcie, the host and founder of Trapital, and today you're going to hear another conversation from our Trapital Summit. This one is all about music and media rights and the ever-changing content space, and I'm joined by the founder and CEO of Harborview Equity Partners, Charisse Clark Suarez. Charisse has been on the show before, but both Harborview and the music rights landscape have evolved quite a bit since then. And includes a wider range of artists in its portfolio, including Bruno Mars, Wiz Khalifa, Christy McVie from Fleetwood Mac, and a whole lot more. So we talk about Harborview's strategy, the bridge generation, as Charisse calls it, and why that is so valuable right now. What do the deals look like that Harborview passes on, and how they look at other deals like media and entertainment companies, sports, and a whole lot more. Really great conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Let's dive in.
Hello, podcast listeners. I have a question for you. What if you had a window into the digital startup world? What if you could ask the tech veterans what it feels like to create a world-class product? How to recover from critical mistakes? How to scale your solution to the masses? How do you get from an idea on the back of a napkin to a fully functioning product? What if you could hear the human stories about how they delivered technology? What if there was a show where you could hear those stories?
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Spent 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what
to do
next.
Took many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
A company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve
more. Most proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a
pain. Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time.
The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, mind
you. Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story.
Make sure you subscribe to the Code Story podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And thanks again for listening.
The second half of the day is going to shift a little bit. We're going to talk about entertainment and media. We're going to talk about leadership. We're also going to talk about ownership and what that looks like in all aspects of the business. And to kick things off, to talk about entertainment and media acquisitions, I'm joined by the founder and CEO of Harborview Equity Partners, Charisse Clark Suarez. What has it been like to see the space mature to what it is today?
Listen, the space has been good to see the maturation. I like to say sometimes that the science experiment is over. The asset class has grown up. It's much more institutionalized. You now see a lot of capital that is coming into the business that's smart and sophisticated, but also recognizes deeply the value that the creative ecosystem really brings to the table and how do we think about that. The last 5 years have been really good to me with respect to how we've seen data analytics, how we've seen the proliferation of streaming really support investors, particularly investors who invest in us, but also investors like ourselves, be able to have the intrinsic information to be able to make smart decisions and to be able to defend that to the investing community, which, you know, as a child who grew up financing the entertainment business, I was very self-aware. I'd walk into a room and everybody who I was trying to convince to support investments that I was going to make immediately saw red, right? Like they saw their whole screen go red and they were losing all of their money. But in the current environment, we've been able to see some real underlying fundamentals that help to support the business that give you the ability to then underwrite the business and give us the fuel to be able to support the creative ecosystem the way that we want to.
One of the things that has stood out to me about your business is the age of the catalog, because we've seen a lot of the deals that come through in the catalog space. A lot of it is for legendary artists, but from the 70s and 80s. The average age of the Harborview catalog is 12 years. So that's 2012. That's Lord Royal. I think that's Blurred Lines around that time frame. And I feel like that is a unique aspect of how you run the business and what your strategy is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, one of the things that we're trying to do is make sure that we future-proof the asset base that we have. We have amazing legacy artists like Fleetwood Mac in our portfolio or like Pat Benatar. We have a legacy jazz musician who I cannot announce right now who's also in the portfolio. But what I know about that is that's my nostalgia music. That's the music that I grew up on, that I revere and think about my parents dancing to, think about my mother celebrating. My kids, not so much. My 9-year-old doesn't really know who Pat Benatar is or who doesn't really know who Fleetwood Mac is. And what we want to make sure is that we are balancing the way that we think about investing such that we don't have any obsolescence risk if we're too far all the way to the right. But then we don't have a lot of one-hit wonder risk if we're too far to the left either, right? So the thought process for us is really building a portfolio that we think can stand the test of time, that has real legs to it. Like in 20 years from now, my kids probably will be listening to Usher as a nostalgia because that's what I listen to, right? Or they might be listening to 24 Karat Magic, you know, or Treasure, which was my daughter's first birthday song. So it's a special place in my heart. But they'll likely be listening to that in 20 years from now. I don't know if they will be listening to Fleetwood Mac in 20 years from now. They may, you know, it's our job to basically be reinvesting in how that catalog appears in the marketplace so that they can know it and they can see it. But there's no guarantee. And so that's how we've thought about it. The nice benefit to that is we have no less than, I think, 25 active artists that are on tour right now, you know? And so we think of our portfolio of assets as almost like the bridge generation. We have things where, you know, or assets and songs and titles that the youth want to experience. They have a familiarity with it. We have a number of titles that have been requested to be in Fortnite festival, for example, because you need both nostalgia, but also awareness. And so that's been very intentional in our strategy. That's just different than how other people have looked at it. But the only way that we can really defend how to do that, a lot of people will default to doing things that are only the 70s and 80s classics because I don't have to worry about forecasting decay. I don't have to worry about any of those things. You have to have an ability to use data, to use the intrinsic information to support the thesis around doing things that are sort of, like I said, in that bridge generation of vintage.
It's about digging deeper into the more recent, the shallow catalog, if you will, because whether it's artists actively on tour and things like that, there are data points that can give you at least some insight as whether or not this song may age better than others. And at the beginning, we had a stat in the presentation about songs that came out in 2018 that were released in 2018 versus today and seeing how different that is. But I'm sure there's certain trends that can give you the indication of being like, yeah, that artist, they may have done really well that year, but this artist has the legs and there are little things you can see.
Yeah, absolutely. The other place that we've seen that and which we absolutely love is we've seen a lot of really interesting things in the independent space because of that reason. Like what we love about investing today is that today the audience tells you where to go. The audience cares. And as we do that, then we just follow that. It's not my job. I respect the jobs of those who do the curation on the front end, who do the artist development. That's just a special part of the life cycle, and it's really necessary. But my job is to basically see where things have gone. And so that is really just following where the fandom is and really supporting those artists in a really unique way. And that allows us to basically have the diversity that we have in the catalog from everything from legacy classic rock all the way to, you know, beautiful independent artists that lots of people like mainstream media maybe doesn't cover, but we know that their fandom is hyper engaged. It led us into places well before everybody else did in regional Latin music. You know, a lot of people weren't thinking about regional Latin music 2.5 years ago. We did. And we were able to benefit from a lot of that kind of like hyper growth in that space. And we're really proud of that because one, we didn't ignore a community that most people may not be seeing. But then two, we also got to participate in the upside alongside that as well.
That reminds me of something that you had mentioned once where you talk about fame and how fame can be somewhat of an indicator, but it can also be a bit of a trap because if you're making investments based on how famous or big name an artist is, that may correlate with the data of revenue sometimes, but sometimes it may not. And I feel like the independent artist example is an opportunity to highlight the opposite, where this artist may not be famous, but they actually may drive it more
or
revenue.
They may not be globally famous. So this is the other thing too. When you're a kid from Queens who grew up to Caribbean parents and you listen to, you know, soca music or one of your favorite artists is Kes the Band, this audience probably doesn't know who that is. But if you took that Trinidad Carnival or, you know, Labor Day weekend in New York and you had Kes perform, the whole thing is sold out. He's famous to me. So like the thing is that we've lived in a society around entertainment and media specifically, it's not just specific to music, where fame was pushed down on us. And there's so many communities whose people who are heroes to them were never celebrated from as a global phenomenon. But they were famous to us. I mean, you couldn't tell me that Marshall Montano is not the Prince or Michael Jackson of the Caribbean. People are like in awe when they see him because that's important to them. So the data has been freeing, actually. It has opened up your eyes to all these other people who don't get to be seen because it's not a global phenomenon, but it is very specific to those audiences, which I think is a beautiful thing.
That can be much more impactful than, again, some of the big names that can have a lot of shallow breadth across the board, but you don't know if that's actually going to be a worthwhile investment.
That's right. We've seen the opposite. I definitely will not name any names, but there are people who have been uber famous, but the cash flows have not followed on the music side. They've been uber famous because they've gotten endorsement deals or they've gotten, you know, they've been in a lot of film and television or they've done a lot of other things. But the fandom for their music is not does not correlate as tightly.
For you, you have to tie it back to what is the asset that I own, right?
Because yeah, I mean, my job is simple.
Yeah.
Los Angeles County, who is an investor, gives me money. I invest the money. I give it back to them plus a return. They give me more money. If I'm investing behind something that is not going to create a return for the teachers and firefighters and retirees of Los Angeles County, they won't give me more money to invest. And so I can't just go on it feels good or being completely seduced by the fame of it all. It won't work out for me too well. It'll be very short-lived. And I don't think we want that.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric Stat of the Week. On Sunday, November 3rd, 2024, the music industry lost a legend. Quincy Jones passed away at 91 years old. And his relationship with Michael Jackson might be the most important producer-artist relationship in the history of recorded music. Jones produced Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad, three of Michael Jackson's biggest albums. Michael's Spotify monthly listeners had jumped from 50 to 55 million at the end of October, most of that largely due to Halloween and the popularity of Thriller, but it'll be interesting to see if we may see an additional slight bump in the coming weeks too, especially with Quincy Jones passing away and the massive influence that he had not only on Michael Jackson's career, but on any popular music that came out after that point. Let's get back to the episode. I think too, part of your job is in acquiring these assets, it's not just buying and holding, it's finding ways to work the asset, maximize it. And we could talk about an example. So in 2023, last year, July 2023, there's an announcement that came out that Harborview had bought $50 million stake in Nelly's recorded music. And about a month later or shortly after that, I'm sure the deal happened before, but at least after the announcement, NLE Choppa releases this song, It's Getting Hot, which uses the sample from Hot in Here from Nelly. Can you walk us through what that time frame looked like and what your firm's involvement may have been in that?
Yeah, so I cannot take credit for the amazing job that Nelly and his management team did for specifically that, or that Choppa did for deciding that that was a sample that he wanted to use. But when we're on the other side of a transaction that we have closed with an artist and artist community, we spend time talking to that artist, trying to understand what it is and what kind of relationship they want to have with us. We are more than just investing in music. We're investing across the entertainment and media ecosystem. So we've, you know, invested in Hell's Kitchen. We also happen to own a lot of the songs from Alicia Keys' first albums that are in Hell's Kitchen, the musical. We have recently announced doing a slate of music biopics, with the first one being on Queen Latifah. We happen to have a couple of Queen Latifah tracks in the portfolio. We have a team that's fully focused on thinking through, you know, creative partnerships and licensing opportunities. as they come across the transit. And we are very thoughtful about the things that we will say yes to and the things that we will say no to, because we don't think that they're aligned with the artist or their wishes or their concerns around what it may be a part of. So these are all things that we're really focused on, but we're focused on things that are in our control, not things that are not in our control. So that's how we think about really trying to make sure that we're driving value. Some artists are fine to sell. They go left, we go right. Some want a more engaged relationship, and we've got an amazing team. We have about 30 full-time professionals, so it's not just me in a garage. We've got a super dope team, and our team is intentionally cross-disciplinary. So I've got all the traditional Wall Street kids, but I've got a full team of people that grew up in the business, managing artists, growing up at a label, being on the licensing side of the business as well, that can really help us make sure that every opportunity that we're looking at, we don't have a blind spot. That's important to me. In the same way that my entire team, if we put up instead of my headshot on here, you would see that we intentionally look like the world, because our denominator is a global audience. And so we have everyone from every walk of life, because we want to make sure that we're not missing where opportunity sets are. So we bring all that together so that we can then sit down with an artist group and a management group and say, okay, what do you want to do next? And the places that we have deep relationships, we can start to think about other things that they'd like to do. But it's not one size fits all, because A, we don't have enough resources to do it for the over 300 artists that we have in our portfolio. But B, if something's, especially because the average age of our tenure of our catalog is about 12 years old, we have active working artists who care deeply about how and what they do, and they're doing a great job at it. So we sort of stay out of the way, but we want to be fueled to their fire. We want to basically be supportive when they want us to be. And we've got different case studies of things that we will do that are bespoke to them and partner across our team to do so.
With your job as well, you say yes to a fair amount of things, but you also say no to a lot. You say no to most. You're an investor. And I think when we had talked, you shared around 10% of the things that come to your desk are things you actually say yes to. I imagine that most of that 90% are things that don't fit the purview that we've talked about. But are there any things that you look at from like an anti-portfolio perspective of like, oh, that one could have been interesting, but we didn't quite close the deal, or that one was competitive and we just...
There's definitely things that are competitive. We've seen things that we would have loved to have, but they chose to go a different route because someone paid them a dollar more or otherwise. I'd say that's the exception rather than the rule. It's not every day. The things that we end up caring about, there is a fit. There is a like meeting of the minds. Like we're looking deep into each other's eyes and we've fallen in love, I think, across the aisle. And those are the things that kind of really work for us. You can't fall in love with everybody. So, you know, that is, you know, true for life. And so the things that we're curating are carefully curated to not only fit our parameters from an economic perspective, but really fit like, can we add value here? Is this going to be a good relationship for us? We want people to have good experiences with us. We want people to walk away and say good things, because that's a virtuous cycle of getting better and better opportunities on a go-forward basis as well.
That makes sense. And shifting gears a bit, or taking a step back, we talked a lot about music, but you've also invested a lot more in entertainment and in media. It's a very different landscape there, because especially in music streaming, it's very data driven. You're able to find out exactly what the trends look like. Every DSP can tell me what percentile fan I am of every artist. And with a lot of these video streaming services, it's a lot less vague. You have these random Netflix data dumps. You have these top 10 lists that don't necessarily tell you the magnitude of certain things. So as someone that is running a company that is data-driven, how does your approach differ from music to media?
So a couple things. One is that we are still very focused on audience, right? So if you think about video content, film content, television content, a lot of that is about who's the audience and how do you get to them and how do you make something that is cost-efficient to deliver to that audience against the revenue opportunity you have. That's still all data, but the data is on the front end around identifying audience. One of the beautiful things I love about having done music first is that because it is so data rich, it actually tells us a lot about audience. It tells us a lot about who's, you know, how they're organized, what they care about, how to get to them effectively and efficiently, who is undernourished from a content perspective. And that gives us a lot of insight as to where we want to go next from a content perspective, right? So, you know, we invested in Macro Media, which is led by Charles King, a dear friend of mine. We also recently invested in Mucho Mas, which is a Latin-focused television and film company. We have a couple other things on the docket too. And a lot of this, again, is informed by things we see on the music side, places where we see there could be very natural synergies with the portfolio that we have, artists who have expressed an interest on being just a musician, wanting to sort of expand in some of these other segments, whether it's film, television, sports even, how that's the lens through which we look. But it starts first from like, where do we see an audience that's undernourished but super hungry to participate in the content, to participate in the ecosystem overall?
Right. So it's looking at whether it's a heat map or some type of idea to just identify what are the trends that can help us infer similar data.
Infer, but also identify and target. So we have developed our own proprietary data platform. I've talked about it in other spaces. It's called HITS. It helps us on the music side, but it's also started to help us on the film and television side too. We've develop something that gives us a little bit of a heat maps on how and where things are performing against zip codes. And it allows us to then say, okay, this is a thing that we know is going to work in these areas. And how do we then micro target those areas? Because I do believe that because content is so much more nuanced, that now I think the nuance is good. Like, I'm actually super excited. I know there's lots of pain right now across the media landscape with all of the various layoffs and all of the various restructurings that are happening. But as an investor with dry powder, it's actually a really exciting time to me, because a lot of these shifts will still need to result in two things: creators who are still there with lots of ideas abound, and then all of us who are watching more television than we've ever watched, watching more things than we've ever seen, reading more books than we've ever read in our lives. If we put together all of our Paramount Plus, Netflix, you know, Disney Plus, whatever, all of our subscriptions, we're probably paying now today more than we even paid for cable back in the day. Those are macroeconomic dynamics that I find super exciting to invest behind, especially in the context for disruption. It feels like the film and television business is in its Napster era right now. And we all know where music kind of came to on the other side of Napster in terms of value and value creation over time. So for me, that's like really exciting.
And especially on the video side, it's that constant unbundling, rebundling that we just keep seeing happen time and time again. On the media side specifically, though, you're not just looking at particular content or videos or companies themselves. You're also looking at networks. Last year, there was Harborview's name that came in for a report when BET was being rumored for a sale. I know that's a company that has continued to be flown out there. But what does your diligence process look like for a company like that?
In a lot of ways, we are very traditional investors. Like, for something like that or anything in those media platform spaces, we're going to do like a traditional throwback old school MBA talk and do a SWOT analysis. We're going to try to understand what the strengths and the weaknesses are, or the opportunities or the threat are for any opportunity set that we're looking at, and try to identify, again, how do we add value to that? All of these media platforms today that, you know, we're looking at, they all have different kind of strengths and weaknesses. And so how do you think about positioning them for the future? A lot of what we're thinking through is like, can you position or reposition those businesses for the future? And that's kind of very traditional, bottoms up. Who's the team? What's the outlook? Where's revenue coming from? What are the threats on opportunities, et cetera?
And I imagine that with an asset like that specifically, it can be a little bit interesting because you have bidders that are always putting their names out there. It becomes a bit public, and it also can lead to not necessarily being able to get the clearest picture on what's happening, because everyone's trying to sell up the asset to some extent, and it's companies trying to do things. So I imagine that deals like that, especially at that M&A level, can be a bit more.
Yeah, detailed. And M&A, like large-scale M&A or any kind of M&A, is actually, it's just a much longer like timeline and life cycle. We've been pretty acquisitive on the music side, you know, as painful as some of these transactions can be on the music side, they're actually nothing in compared to, like, you know, big picture M&A, because it just takes a lot. There's a lot of different moving pieces. As you've seen a lot of these things play out in the press, a lot of drama associated with them. The probability or the success rate on execution on those things is very, you know, it's a lot lower in terms of, you know, certainty of execution, but that's just part of the job.
I know another place that you're looking at is sports. Similarly, what does that look like for you? Is that investing in teams themselves, investing in companies that are tangentially connected to sports, all of the above?
We've taken a look at a lot of opportunities in sports. We haven't found the right one yet. But again, it goes back to, we've built an ecosystem. We want our artists that come into that ecosystem to be able to participate, to help us to look to see ways that we can connect 1 + 1 = 10. That is really a big goal of ours. We believe that it's all family. We're all cousins at the cookout trying to make something great happen. In the context of sports, the way that we think about that is like, Are there teams where we can add value from our ecosystem? Are there relationships that we can bring to bear to drive the storytelling, to drive the elevation of their brand? Are there opportunities where we can bring our relationships around branding and merchandising to add value to the overall brand value of the teams? We looked at a European football team or soccer team, I guess, for those of us sitting here. We came close to that, but it just wasn't the right cap table dynamic. We've spent some time on some women soccer teams here in the U.S. We've looked at some sports adjacent, sort of either media rights or other things. The space is frothy. There's a lot of like all the big players like all talk about wanting to be in sports. We want to be a little bit more bespoke around the solution, around how we, again, intersect our ecosystem against that. But we're definitely open to the right opportunities.
The interesting thing about some of these team investments from what I've seen and even friends that have sent things or passed them along is that the buy-ins are normally fairly high, but a lot of those buy-ins are still for having a small aspect of a
minority
stake. Exactly. Yeah. Like, hey, you can do this. Hey, you can come in the suite.
Right.
Come sit courtside.
I don't do bragging rights.
And yeah, you're not a celebrity investor.
No, I'm not. I'm definitely the antithesis of a celebrity investor for a lot of reasons. Because again, remember I said that I used to go into rooms and people be like, oh my God, I lost all my money on this thing. Our job is to basically be the translator. Like, we really want to scale our enterprise. Like, we've got $2 billion of regulatory AUM, but the truth of the matter is, like, I want to get to 100. So, like, I'm not going to get there if I do something that's flashy, but it burns. So we have to be really thoughtful about making sure that our investors, the people that we work on behalf of, the teachers, the firefighters, the retirees that we're working on behalf of, that we're working to make their dollar make sense. We're investing in this ecosystem because we believe in the importance of content, right? Like, content tells stories around the world. It brings us all together. We all love music. We all have a soundtrack to our lives. Like, it is important, deeply important to the human condition, which is a great thing to invest behind. But I can't only invest behind the shininess of it because that's how people get burned. And if I get burned, again, we're not, you know, then it's all for naught. And so we're really, really careful around that. And so a lot of these sports things that are just vanity plays are not for us.
I know. In some ways, a lot of these deals that we see for the investments that happen now remind me of a lot of the athlete record labels or a lot of the athlete clothing labels that we would see 20 years ago, where that was the wave. And obviously, it's an investment. You know that not everything's going to turn out, but we see a lot of the names come up and it's like, great, you know, we want to see folks like us having equity stakes in these companies, but we also want to make sure that there's diligence involved with those decisions.
Yeah, there's always going to be diligence, but also for us, we don't want to just be a check. We want to make sure that we can be impactful. And can we be impactful in the situation? And maybe there's a lot of places that we can't, which is totally fine, but it's just not the right situation for us.
Blue Ocean in the future, we talked about music, we talked about entertainment, we talked about sports. Are there any other areas that even if Harborview isn't focused in now that you could see in the future?
Well, I think what we want to be is a holistic capital solution for those segments. So like right now, you know, we buy assets or we invest in companies. We'd love to create a credit platform over time. We'd love to create things that are a bit earlier stage in terms of investing strategy. So something closer to the growth side. There are ways to think about us as an asset manager that has four or five flagship products, if that makes sense. And then our ability to basically be a holistic solution. So when someone comes in and says, hey, I got this asset that I want to sell, but I also have this business I want to think about financing, but I also have this opportunity that we're thinking about starting up. Like, our firm will have the resources, both from a capital perspective and an expertise perspective, to really support that. Like, our goal is to be massively impactful to our segments. And so the way to do that is to be expertly focused, not get distracted on our sectors, but build out our product suite so that we can do that. We want to be supportive. We want to fuel the creative ecosystem as much as possible.
And before we close things out, you, like several of the speakers that we've had today, run a company where a lot of people that want to do business with your firm want to talk to you. And how do you navigate that where you're building out the business, but they still see you and they want to be able to speak with Charisse. They want to talk to Charisse.
This business is my third baby. I tell everybody I have two children. My daughter's 12, my son is 9, and my business is 4 years old. And so for any of you who have children, a 4-year-old is a toddler. And so the toddler no longer needs the child locks on the door. They can probably put food in their mouth, but you still need to basically be ever present. So that's where we are in the business. And so I accept that. It's still a lot of hard labor years for me. I'm excited for when the business goes to middle school or high school so that I can get a little bit of a breather. But I get it that I'm demanded in a lot of places, whether that's with investors, whether that's with people that we want to work with in terms of investing, whether that's with our stakeholders broadly, our team. That's kind of the space that I'm in right now. But we have an amazing team. And I promise you, if we say like, hey, talk to somebody on our team, you're not getting second fiddle. You're getting the greatest piece of it. But I do understand that. I do have sometimes have to like defend my time and be a bit ruthless with my time. That's my like 2024 goal. I'm still working on it, candidly, but trying to be definitely a little bit more protective of my time such that I can make sure that we can get to this highest order business. We're not getting to 100 billion. If I have to take every small call, I got to go help us leapfrog.
Charisse, thank you.
No, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Charisse Clark Suarez. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.